Welcome to the China Meaning Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlanta Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. Minilateralism is one of the many buzzwords we've been hearing a lot of in the Middle East in the past few years. Smaller groupings of states working together on specific issues where their interests converge seems to be a growing trend, bringing countries together in partnerships that would have been unusual even just a few years ago. These minilaterals are typically region or country specific, but it's also easy to see how some of them are responses to shifting geopolitics as well. To talk us through these Middle East minilaterals, I'm happy to be joined today by Dr. Jean-Louis Saman, who is a senior research fellow at the Middle East Institute of the National University of Singapore, as well as a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlanta Council. His research covers Middle Eastern security affairs, in particular the reforms of Gulf Armed Forces, Israel's evolving military strategy, and the evolution of non-state warfare in the region. He wrote a great report for the Atlanta Council last summer on the spread of minilaterals in the region that I recommend to anyone who's thinking through these configurations. Jean-Louis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's a pleasure to shift from the position of listener to a guest. So thank you very much for that honor.
Great to have you here. So let's just start with a brief overview of minilaterals. We've done projects together and it keeps coming up. And in the beginning, I was a bit of a skeptic. And, I think other people might as well. So what are they and why are we seeing so many of them these days?
Well, I mean, the first challenge when we talk about minilaterals is both the definition and the history. When that started and when can you say that this is a minilateral arrangement or not? The expression itself is quite old. We can find it like 20 years ago with discussions, even in the 90s or in the early 2000s, where there were a lot of discussions on minilaterals. At the time, it was mostly on governance, let's say non-security related governance. But more recently, I would say that in the last 10 years, the discussion on minilaterals grew in earnest. And that started mostly in Asia, where we saw mostly through U.S. initiatives, minilaterals between the U.S., Japan, South Korea. And maybe the most emblematic minilateral would be AUKUS, the US, UK, Australia arrangement or alliance that was announced in 2021. Now, this is, let's say, more or less the history of the last two decades. The problem is, how do you define it? And so far, the way you look at the scholarship, people assume that this is either something between three members and up to seven or eight members. So it's actually quite approximate. You could argue that the concept of Europe, the way Europe was defined by alliances against each other during the 19th century, was just a competition of minilaterals. So that's the problem, the challenge of definition. Having said that, in the Middle East, this is much more recent. In a way, you could argue that what we call today the minilaterals started after the Abraham Accords between Israel, the UAE, and Bahrain. And this is mostly about what we call I2U2. So this new arrangement that includes India, Israel, US, and United Arab Emirates. But again, you could argue that a lot of previous initiatives, previous arrangements could also qualify for minilaterals. And for instance, the so-called Quartet of Against Terror, which was composed of Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and Egypt in 2017 against Qatar. This more or less qualify also as a minilateral. So the main lesson from that is that this is a volatile notion that it's usually the problem with this type of buzzword. But that doesn't mean that we should dismiss it or ignore it, because this is more and more an instrument or a mechanism that diplomats and military officers in the region like to use.
Okay, thanks. That was a really great overview. So you mentioned a couple. You mentioned I2U2. You mentioned the anti-terror quartet. We have seen a lot of these configurations in the Middle East in recent years. In the report you published with the Atlantic Council last summer, you went into quite a bit of detail in three or four of them. So can you give us an overview? What are the main mini-laterals in the Middle East, and what are they expected to achieve?
Yes, so let's say that the first or the most important one these days is I2U2, as mentioned earlier. This one, which includes not just Middle Eastern countries such as the UAE and Israel, but maybe more importantly also India. This is a US-led initiative. And when that was announced the first time in late 2021, it was quickly coined as the Middle East Quad. So you can see already the connection the movement of Asian minilaterals being imported to the Middle East. So initially, as I said, I mean, the speculation about I2U2 was that this would be more or less the Middle East branch of the Quad that the U.S. had built in Asia, and that include also India, Japan, and Australia. However, we saw very quickly with the I2U2 arrangement that the agenda is more about economic trade relations and less about security affairs. We could maybe discuss that later, but you could argue that two countries from that minilateral were more cautious about, or were, let's say, not really comfortable with the idea of being part of a Middle East Quad that implicitly targets China. That would be the UAE and Israel. The US and India were much more comfortable because they don't have any issue with an arrangement such as this one, especially because they are also part of the Asian Quad. So that's, I would say, the first minilateral arrangement that comes to mind in the Middle East. There is another one which at the moment I would say is in limbo, which is the Negev Forum. I said earlier that a lot of those minilateral talks started or were triggered by the wave of normalization between Israel and Arab countries, and in particular two Gulf states, UAE and Bahrain. What we saw after that is Israel raising its diplomatic ambitions in creating this new conference, which was the Negev Forum. This Negev Forum, which was initially taking place, obviously, in Israel in 2022, we only saw one edition so far. This was to include Israel, Morocco, Egypt, UAE, Bahrain, the US. Interestingly, at the time, Jordan was invited but refused to join the Negev Forum. In retrospect, it's quite interesting because Jordan was complaining that the Negev Forum, which was supposed to discuss security issues, did not discuss enough the Palestinian issue. That was the Jordanian position at the time. So the Negev Forum was supposed also to be that type of minilateral arrangement. And finally, another interesting example of minilaterals might be the recent trilateral arrangement between France, the UAE, and India. I mentioned this one because it's one that doesn't include the US and which specifically does not want to antagonize China. If you ask French officials, Emirati officials, or Indian officials, they are very, very cautious to say that this trilateral arrangement has nothing to do with China. And in a way, it's also used by those countries as a way to distance themselves from other US-led minilaterals. So that would be another example. Maybe we'll have time also to discuss IMEC, which is also something a bit different. the India, Middle East, Europe corridor, which arguably is not exactly a mini lateral. This is more like an extension or an escalation of mini laterals. But that's at the moment the biggest initiatives I would mention. There are other more ad hoc mini lateral discussions, but which didn't go, I would say, more further than just informal talks between some of those countries. So I don't think there's enough to say on those. But again, I2U2 and the Negev Forum or the French India UAE trilateral would be some of the most relevant cases here.
Yeah, that's really great. You know, while you're listing them off, Israel is really central to a lot of these projects, except the last one you discussed, the France, India, UAE. But of course, Israel's working, like you said, with I2U2 and so many other things. So how does current events, you know, the war in Gaza and, you know, the reluctance among some states to work with Israel, how does this affect Israel's role in these going forward?
That's a great question, and maybe the most obvious one. As you said at the beginning, the report I wrote for the Atlantic Council was published maybe 2 months before the war in Gaza started. So I experienced the nightmare that any researcher on the Middle East faces when you have a topic and suddenly everything is basically changing overnight and challenging the findings. I think there are several aspects that have to be discussed if we want to address the issue of minilaterals after the Gaza war. But first of all, I don't think the topic is going away. If you ask officials these days, either in Washington or elsewhere, they are still very interested in the topic. This can no longer be designed as it was before. I think the biggest issue with the minilateral approach, and in particular for I2U2 and the Negev Forum, maybe even more for the Negev Forum than for I2U2, was that the narrative behind those minilaterals was, let's build economic ties, let's prioritize trade and put security aside. That was the main narrative. If you ask, I remember asking Gulf commentators or officials at the time, especially about I2U2, and they were very, very vocal on the fact that this is about business. We don't want to discuss security. And you could almost sound like you were a hawk asking about security issues. So the main assumption was it's business first, and that will eventually lead to the stabilization of the region. And the other, maybe even more perilous or risky, the riskier assumption was that there's no need to discuss the Israel-Palestine issue. To be fair, this was not just an issue with the minilaterals. This was, I would say, regional diplomacy as a whole. For many years, felt like the Israel-Palestine issue was frozen. The Abraham Accords started with this idea that you need to change the logic of Israel's normalization with the Arab world. It needs to be disconnected from the Palestinian issue, because the Palestinian issue is no longer is actually a deadlock. So the assumption was, let's build those minilaterals. This will improve regional governance. And eventually, at a certain point, this will lead to a progress on the Palestinian issue. And this was not shared by everyone. some countries in particular in the region, and I mentioned earlier Jordan. Jordan maybe was from the beginning the most critical country on those issues, on those initiatives, because Jordan felt, no, the Palestinian issue is still at the center. The belief was you cannot build all those ties without discussing first the Palestinian issue. So I would say that for a while, until October, this vision of minilaterals that prioritize economic ties and put the Palestinian issue in the background, that seemed to work. And that explains why the Biden administration was quite optimistic about the Middle East. I mean, that's in a way the reason why Jake Sullivan, a few days before October 7, was bragging about the idea that the Middle East is more stable today than 20 years ago, because you had these different initiatives, and that looked like something unprecedented for the Middle East, to have all those new formats of discussion, and discussion, again, that we're not looking at military security issues, but more about business, trade. So it felt like the Middle East was no longer this area of conflict, but a potential area of prosperity. So again, I think this is this narrative is no longer sustainable, but that doesn't mean that the minilaterals are gone. I think the challenge is to change the logic and to use those arrangements, especially, for instance, the Negev Forum. I think after the war in Gaza ends, there is definitely a need for greater consultations between the regional actors, and without dismissing the Palestinian issue. It's no longer the way I would imagine the Negev Forum, but actually putting the Palestinian issue, the reconstruction of Gaza, the peace process at the center of a forum like this. So you can already imagine the minilaterals being even more relevant than they were in the first place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I absolutely take your point about how the way folks in the region are recalibrating, but I don't think the underlying spirit of you know, this de-escalation and let's try to find developmental solutions and economic solutions to the region's problems. I mean, that animating spirit seemed to be driving a lot of this stuff prior to October 7th. And I don't think that's gone away. I think leaders and you know, business leaders and political actors all still feel the same way, that if you're going to solve the region's problems, it's probably not going to be through geopolitical competition like it has been for a long time, or through interference in each other's countries, but trying to build, you know, supply chains and business clusters and invest in each other and make the region just a place where people want to invest and set up businesses and trade with each other.
Yes. I mean, the other thing that has to be discussed is the China factor, because as mentioned earlier, some of these initiatives, and in particular I2U2, it's less the case for the Negev Forum or the French India UAE arrangement, but in particular for I2U2, the big assumption was that this is about China, and it's going to be interesting to see how the change in regional diplomacy and the need to rediscuss the Palestinian issue may force this China factor to be maybe less important. That's one way to look at it. The other possible scenario is to see some of the regional actors looking for more engagement with China through this type of similar arrangements. So far, we don't see any similar arrangement between China and either Israel or any of the Arab partners. But I wouldn't be surprised if in coming months we see more and more interest, especially in the Gulf, to have the same type of engagement with China. Maybe, I'm just speculating, but one of the other consequences of the Gaza war, I think, is frustration towards the US and towards the West in general. So this may actually also bring those countries to reconsider those arrangements and think, let's keep the template, the minilateral template, but let's do that with other countries. Because so far it's mostly US-led initiatives. Let's try to have something like this with China or with India, but without the US. So this, again, this is pure speculation at this point, but if we try to imagine the future of those arrangements, this may also come into play. And this might be a big challenge also for the US. How do you react? How do you position yourself with any other arrangement that excludes Washington?
That's a great segue. Thanks for doing that, because I was trying to find a way to bring us back to the China part of the China MENA podcast here. And I agree. I mean, I think if you read a lot of the commentary, you'll hear, you know, talk of China, Russia, Iran, minilateral as well, right? That these countries are acting in concert on certain issues. And I think one thing we should all be worried about, China has very, very real interests in the region, and China does have a role to play in a lot of the, especially certainly the developmental issues, the economic issues. The more you push it away, the more you're driving it into countries, partnerships that you may not want, right? If China's opportunities with some of these more status quo oriented countries start to diminish through, you know, these US India centered configurations, then it forces China to work with countries that are less supportive of the status quo, and that could be just as problematic. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, when I2U2 was announced, I was asked to write a report for the Middle East Council in Doha about how would I imagine Beijing responding to this type of thing. And my take was, how could Beijing see this as anything but Middle East Quad? And like you said, I think for India and the U.S., because obviously they're in a quad, so it's there. But you're right. I think at the time, Israel was less inclined to want to be seen as confrontational towards China or less welcoming to China. And the UAE certainly didn't seem very interested in that. So we saw the narrative change a bit. How do you see that? I mean, what we've talked about mostly is about these minilaterals as responses to regional pressures. But in your report, you also talked about how there's this ambiguity at the international systemic level. You know, this U.S.-China competition could be driving this as well. How do these change the strategic environment for external actors who come into the Middle East?
Well, there's, I mean, first of all, you could say that the minilateral phenomenon at the systemic level is one of different consequences of this new transition of power or this type of uncertainty that is brought about by the US-China competition, and the fact that regional actors such as Israel, Gulf states, want to either diversify or to change their foreign policy and have to reconsider their exclusive alignment or reliance on the US. So the same way we discussed, and you discussed many times in the podcast, the relations of those countries with China at the bilateral level, you could argue that the minilaterals are also a consequence of this ambiguity and this more volatile regional environment. Having said that, I mean, just on the Israeli aspect of I2U2, because as we were talking about it, I may change or I may revise the idea that Israel today would be still cautious about the China factor, because clearly after October 7, and you had discussions on that in the podcast, I think the Israelis have come to the realization, and they had already come to that realization, but maybe that was the final step to consider that China is not a strategic partner, that it is at best just a trade partner, but that's it. And I think they probably, after the Gaza war, they won't have any issue with the U.S. Narrative on China. And I think that's a major development with regards to Israel. With regards to the UAE, clearly, the Gaza war, in a way, confirms a lot of their assumptions about the need to have not a rebalancing of their policy from the U.S. Towards China, but more a diversification and to add as many options as possible. And minilaterals contribute to that. Now, the problem, I mean, the positive view on minilateral is that it brings about new mechanisms, processes to discuss among all of those countries. It is useful for a region like the Middle East, where historically there has never been a strong security architecture. There isn't a European Union or NATO for the Middle East. The Gulf Cooperation Council was unable to solve any of its own issues, either with external actors such as Iran or Iraq, but even within its own organization, the GCC was completely irrelevant during the blockade of Qatar in 2017. Same thing for the Arab League. I mean, the Arab League has never been able to solve any issue, and we can see right now that there is no role, basically, for the Arab League on the Palestinian tragedy. So the positive view is minilaterals are a first step. It actually compensates for that absence of security architecture. The negative view would be that minilaterals do not create any robust mechanism, any strong process or any institution. I mean, most of those minilaterals we are discussing do not have like a permanent bureaucracy. So this is basically relying on the resolve, the motivation, and the resources of those countries on their own, but not with a organization, a secretariat general for ITU2 or for the Negev Forum. So this means that this is just ad hoc. This may just extend, in a way, the absence of security architecture. Or even worse, you could speculate that this deepens the fragmentation of regional regional cooperation, regional diplomacy. I heard from UN officials, for instance, I was talking about the topic of minilaterals with UN officials involved in the Middle East. And their view, that was interesting because I didn't have that view in mind. They were quite skeptical and negative about it. They were saying, well, this is another way to undermine the role of international institutions, wherein you have small meetings, small formats like this. They were concerned that this would only create fragmentation and eventually possible alliances and counter-alliances. I mean, at the moment, we don't see that. But if we look at the history, the recent history of the Middle East, that wouldn't be completely unlikely to see that happening through this mechanism of minilateral. So that's also something that could happen in terms of the regional dynamics.
No, I take that point very, very seriously, because when you look at things like, well, I guess where I want to go with this, with the IMEC, the India Middle East corridor, you kind of see how this kind of regional fragmentation is really firming up. You know, I remember thinking this just before the Saudi-Iran rapprochement was announced, because the week before that, all of the stories in the newspaper were the Saudi-Israel normalization. And it seemed to me that at the time, if Saudi had announced that it was normalizing ties with Israel, then that would be another big piece in that kind of block politics in the Middle East, where the lines would be very clearly drawn. You know, here's a group of countries that are on one side, and here's a group of countries on the other, and that seemed quite combustible. So when Saudi and Iran announced that they were going to have that rapprochement and normalized relations or diplomatic engagement, I took that as pretty good statesmanship to kind of lower the temperatures in the region. When you talk about IMEC, I mean, a couple of the things that I was thinking about while you're talking, one of them was, as the China watcher in the, from this region, you keep seeing whenever the Abraham Accords were announced, it was what's Beijing going to think? This looks like a response to the Belt and Road. And then I2U2, this is a response to the Belt and Road. And then IMEC, which very clearly does seem to be a response to the Belt and Road. So it does seem to draw in, on the one hand, you know, these geopolitical responses to kind of great power competition. On the other hand, you'd think if you're Chinese state-owned companies operating in the region and you see, you know, better infrastructure getting you from one port to another port, then hey, that's a public good, right? That's good for everybody. But just, you know, you did make the point, IMEC isn't a minilateral, but it does show us how these things could operationalize in the future, right? That cooperation on different issues create momentum for bigger stuff that connects these countries and markets and, you know, infrastructure. How do you see it working? I mean, we were both in Washington recently. When I was talking to people, there was, despite the issues in Gaza, there seemed to be a lot of momentum behind the scenes for IMEC and a lot of enthusiasm. And I hear the same thing here. What's your take?
Well, I mean, the IMEC project was initially supposed to be the cherry on the top of all those minilateral initiatives. I think even before we discuss the operational dimension, the investments and the ports, the maritime corridor, the rail project that was supposed to or that is supposed to derive from IMEC, I think at first it's about a narrative. It's about this big narrative that the Biden administration wanted to sell, not just for domestic consumption but also for the region. This was again, based on the same assumptions we discussed earlier, the idea that let's prioritize business, let's prioritize prosperity, and this will stabilize the Middle East. So this was, I mean, this, and this is, I should not use past tense, this is a very ambitious project. I must say, and as you mentioned that we were recently in the US, I was initially thinking, honestly, after October 7, that IMEC was gone, that nobody would be interested either to work with Israel or with the Biden administration, frankly. But you're right that there is still strong appetite. I think this relates to different reasons, and some are good for U.S. interests, some others less. I think first it's the fact that probably on this topic, you would see continuity between the Biden administration and possibly another Trump presidency, if we see that in November, because a lot of those topics, a lot of those initiatives started already in the Trump administration. And on those topics, you can see some similarities, clearly in the assumptions driving both administrations. So You could see a rebranding if we have a Trump presidency, a rebranding of that initiative, maybe not IMEC anymore, but probably the same actors, the same format. Because there is also this idea of building prosperity, focusing on trade instead of security issues. There is still appetite from other actors. You can see that already with the UAE and India that are going forward on some aspects in terms of infrastructure. Now, the thing is that, for instance, on the specific topic of UAE and India that have started investing on infrastructure and talking about those projects as IMEC projects, you could tell that this is a rebranding of bilateral cooperation that was going to happen anyway. The UAE announced many years ago that it would invest in the Indian infrastructures. I think it was back in 2016 or 17 when Mohammed bin Zayed was invited to the National Day of India as the guest of honor, that they announced investment in Indian infrastructure. So I'm not sure if the India-UAE investment projects that we see right now are an indication that IMEC is going forward. It is at least indication that some actors involved in IMEC are going to deepen their relations, no matter what happens with regards to Israel. Interestingly, one country also announced the appointment of a special envoy. I was surprised to hear that my country, France, announced the creation of a special envoy for IMEC. So this is Gérard Mestrallet, who's a former CEO of one of the major gas companies in France. It is an interesting development because you could wonder why a European country would be so active on an initiative that in many ways is a U.S. initiative. As I said earlier, I think it's first and foremost a narrative from the Biden administration. So in recent conversations with French officials, I asked them about why Paris suddenly is embracing U.S. initiatives in the Middle East. That sounds against the DNA of French diplomacy. And actually, the answer was, well, we support IMEC because that's, for us, a mechanism that allows us to deepen our engagement with UAE and India. So we're going back, actually, to the other minilateral I was mentioning earlier, this French-UAE-India arrangement. So France is actually trying to use the IMEC arrangement as a way to promote its own initiative. So you can already anticipate that if all the different actors involved in IMEC use that format for their own benefits without considering a common agenda, this may eventually create some issues. But overall, yes, I agree with you that the initiative is clearly still in the air. But there are things that will need to be considered, and some were already big unknowns before the Gaza war. The financing, I don't think we have any clear idea yet on the funding of those projects that will be part of IMEC. You could argue that a lot of the projects with the Belt and Road Initiative are also made of unclear and opaque financing issues. But on this IMEC project, we don't even know exactly what would be the share of funding between the US and other countries or between governments and private entities. So it's hard to really assess the way this can be implemented. It was, I mean, as I remember, when the project was announced in September, one of the first meetings was supposed to clarify all of those financial issues. As far as I know, that didn't yet lead to any public statements, either from the Biden administration or from other countries, regarding the specificities of the financing. There are other big unknowns. The role of Israel, the role of Israel, and probably also of Palestine in that initiative. The role of Israel was already unclear before the war, because if you look at the statement, the first memorandum of understanding that was signed in September, Israel is not mentioned. Israel is not even signatory of the first MOU between the members of IMEC. There is this this view that Israel is part of the project, but officially there isn't any clear indication on how Israel would be part of it. For instance, when we talk about port infrastructures, would this be through Haifa port? Like, this seemed to be the most likely scenario. But these days you can hear Gulf states, and in particular Emirati views, Emirati commentators saying, well, we could do that with other countries. We could do that with Lebanon. We could do that, and I even heard with Gaza. I mean, obviously, this would need to invest in the reconstruction of a Gaza port. But this also brings about the issue of the Israel-Palestine conflict, as we discussed earlier. I don't think that the future of IMEC can be discussed without considering that again at the center. There's no way you can discuss infrastructure projects like those without considering just the security of the infrastructures in Israel, but also the diplomatic aspects, because a lot of the countries will be mindful of how they are perceived if they start investing in projects that sideline the reconstruction of Gaza and more generally the Palestinian territories.
That was really interesting. I'm a little disappointed that you didn't refer to IMEC as the Biden Road Initiative, as I've heard you use before, which I think is great. Jean-Luc, thanks a lot for this, man. It was really, really interesting. Really cool stuff. I always enjoy talking with you about this stuff, and I think it was really, really helpful for our audience as well.
Well, thank you very much. It was a great pleasure to contribute.
Cool. Well, we'll have to do it again real soon. To our audience, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another very interesting episode. Thanks for joining us, and do all the podcast stuff, like and listen, subscribe and rate, and tell us what you like about us or about the show, or what we could be doing better. Thanks, everybody. See you soon.